I'm happy to talk further. Yes, Mark.
I'm just curious of the first wave of the project coming out of Ron. Could you give me a sense of the range of that work?
Yeah. The first set of materials, the Rossetti Archive, the Whitman Archive, the Blake Archive, these are sort of well-known projects. The Poetess Project that Laura Mandel is developing in Ohio. The Ambrose Bierce Project, Emily Dickinson Project. We've just had a big, I am involved all the time in conversations with people all over about this. And the great Whistler Project that is being built over in Glasgow. That's enormous cache of materials, and that's coming in this summer. And we're talking with a lot of museums and the libraries of a lot of museums to try to bring in their archives. Let me see, what am I forgetting about here? The Swinburne Project that John Walsh is developing in Indiana, that's in the first batch. The Melville project that John Bryant is developing, this new extension from his fluid text work that was published at UVA Press. These are the ones I think of right now. So we have, at the moment, probably about 30,000 separate files that are online. Once Colex gets fully developed, that's the last and in many ways the key tool that we have to develop. This will allow people to actually go to this body of material and begin to use it and then add to it from within inside the system itself. So I have a number of graduate students who are beginning to actually do their scholarly work within the orbit of Nines and in the anticipation of what Nines will become. So their work will then be put into Nines. Like one of them has just finished this wonderful thesis, this study of the textual history of the four Zoas. So it's just massive work. It's a fabulous thing. And I do see that as coming in. This book is like a fundamentally important book in Blake studies. There is no press that would publish this book. It can't be published. And yet, if you're a Blake scholar, you can't imagine not having access to this book. The only way it's going to get published is going to be online. But what we want to do is have these things not just published online so that you can access them, but published in a way so that they're integrated with all other scholarly material. That's what we have right now. That's what the system is. We all know how to use the system. It's the system of libraries, publishing venues of various kinds, periodicals, and all the interstitial bibliographies and so forth that allow you to access this. What we're seeing develop in the digital frame of reference are mechanisms that allow you to do this only on a much broader scale. Yes.
As you're thinking about safeguarding against individual silos, how are you also building mechanisms so that this doesn't become just a mega silo?
Well, the architecture is interesting. A very good question, actually, because I want to answer this question fast rather than the libraries have been approaching it from what is seen as a top-down model. And if you're a librarian, you may know about projects like Fedora. What they are information management systems that are highly articulated in as logical structures. But they exist as a kind of tree that sends down, it, or tree maybe this, depending on how you see it. But all the parts hang off higher level ontological structures. So the whole thing is articulated as a kind of ontology of nested subparts. When you're dealing with, let's say, the kind of body of possible materials, what you want to do is cast your mind and imagine the entire world's libraries as being integrated. what kind of an ontological system are you going to be able to build that is going to be able to hold that? My own opinion is you can't. It's just not possible. So there, and a number of people, you know, a lot smarter than I am about this, I figured this out a number of years ago, and have been working at trying to figure out what are seen as bottom-up or social software, it's called generally, sometimes known as folksonomy. And what you do, what you need to find a way to do is to flatten everything and give everything a unique address. And then use the system of use as the device for organizing the materials. So basically, when you know, say there's a whole bunch of people really interested in Blake, you begin to see a kind of gravitational field emerge out of the use of these things, and the structures then come forward to your attention through the actual practice of people using the material. The system that we're using is a very simple flat address system called RDF. Every file that goes in gets an RDF address. And then you can drill down further if you want. And say in the Rossetti archive, which is the laboratory I've been using to try to investigate these issues, any file, theoretically, any item in any file can be given an RDF address. And so what you want to decide is, what is it in this file that you would want a scholar to be able to get at? So let's say I'm doing Rossetti, and I'm looking at the 1870 poems. The book itself will get an RDF address. Every work in that book will get an RDF address, and every page in the book will get an RDF address. That's the minimal addressing system for the work that I'm using. But you can easily imagine, once you start to structure these things this way, addressing the material in sort of any way that you want. And the because it's a flat addressing system, and because it the structure of the materials is determined by the way people use the materials. If, for example, you identified all the genres, let's say, or let's say you identified all the lines, every single line in the thing was given an RDF address, then the people who are interested in that, let's say they're studying rhyme schemes or something like that, those structures would emerge as people study the structures. That's our approach. And it comes, I tell you this because I was 6 years ago completely committed to the Fedora system, because it really is a very beautiful thing. But as soon as you start to think about Fedora as and try to apply it to something, you know, really gigantic, you realize it's not possible. You can't do it. Yeah.
This is all still very new to me, so excuse you if the question seems vague, but it seems to me that, is this, if I'm getting this right, are you talking both about, with the collect, sort of a search system, but at the same time, Wiki, did I?
It has a lot in common with Wiki. There is no central, the only central location would be a relatively small server that will hold the addresses. But the Rossetti Archive is at the University of Virginia, the library server there. The Whitman Archive is in Nebraska. The Blake Archive is in North Carolina. The Dickinson Archive is in Maryland. The Whistler is in Glasgow. It doesn't matter where it is, and each scholarly entity, person, or say group, that let's say the group that is developing the Whistler materials in Glasgow, they have the responsibility over maintaining that particular object. The addressing system allows everybody to take their own authority over their particular materials. The central editorial group peer reviews this material and then certifies it as being worthy material. And at that point, it is allowed into the closed system. So all these things exist in their silos, except that the software, this RDF software that we use, allows them to be integrated, but not by a top-down, but by a user-up model. Does that answer your question? Sort of.
No, you're answering fine. It's me trying to wrap my mind around this.
Okay. Yes.
If you're using a Googling approach to search a subject, and if you're using number of hits as the salience factor, seems to me that anything really scholarly and academic is going to be at the end of the line in terms of number of hits. The more scholarly something is, the fewer hits it'll get. Is that a problem, or am I wrong in my assumption?
Well, I don't know. This is conceived as a publishing mechanism and a communication mechanism for scholars. And so I assume that when scholars...
How do you get into that special system that's just for scholars, though? Do I have to go into nines? And if so, I can't do anything outside of the 19th century.
We actually having a series of conversations about this. Anybody can go in.
I have to be in there. I can't Google generally.
Anybody, whether you're a 19th century scholar or not, you can go into the nines. It's an open source system.
My point is in general, how do you research something outside of the 19th century, or how do you search something scholarly?
You mean how do you access material outside the 19th century?
Yes, that's good. That's scholarly material.
Scholarly material. We have not addressed that problem. My belief is that you have to start somewhere with something that's controllable. Okay. I have had a number of scholars whom I have a lot of respect for and I work with in German and French and say, why the hell are you selecting only British and American 19th century studies? And my answer is, we couldn't possibly do more. Something else has to be done. This is, in large part, an experiment in trying to address this problem that I tried to talk about in my talk. We're all waiting around for libraries to deal with this. It's wrong. We have got to deal with this. I mean, this room of people have to deal with, because our interests are in here. Librarians, of course, my favorite people are librarians. But their set of interests are not my interests as a scholar. So that's why we're trying to develop these things. But it is, as you say, restricted now. I don't know whether we can get this thing to work. I mean, we've got a lot of people interested in it. We've got a lot of material. We're building it. Can we come November of this year, my funding is gone. I have been working, as my wife knows, for the last 3 months in a maniacal way to try to get 2 more years of funding, because I believe in 2 years we can set the thing up so it will be sustainable. But that's just nines.
Then you would be providing the model for other people who
it's a model.
Set up similar
right.
systems.
I don't know a more flexible way of dealing with this right now. And anybody I talk to about it who is interested in these things can see the virtue of this approach. The Fedora approach is lovely and all that sort of thing. And this, by the way, does not forbid or exclude the possibility of having materials that are themselves organized in a Fedora sort of top-down ontological model. Anything can be out there in whatever form it is, as long as you address all the parts that you want to be searchable in the RDF system.
Thank you.
And by the way, it's easy as pie. If the data is well structured, it takes a couple of hours to do. It's not, rocket science. Yes?
What happens when you lose funding come November?
My life. I get my life back.
Who were you being funded from?
Mellon gave me a lot of money 3 years ago, and I threw all the money at this. And I'm going back to Mellon because I think we've been successful, and I think that they will give us the money we need to finish the work. If they don't, I'm done. I haven't been in the classroom for too long. I miss it awfully, and I'm really easy about it. If they don't fund us, we'll finish what we're doing, and the work that we have done will, in fact, have a certain use even at this point, because we have proved that this model can work.
Thank you.
We know it can. And if somebody else can get the funding to build it, that's fine. It doesn't have to be us. So I'm very easy about that because I do miss my old life. Mark?
Just one more quick question. When the Blake Archive came online and one person came right together, you know, the sort of whole Romantic Circles site was established.
Oh, Romantic Circles, by the way, is also is in Nines.
Part of the Nines.
Yes.
But one of the things I noticed is that not only did it stimulate online publication, peer reviewed, I mean, because, you know, now there's the journal as part of Romantic Circles, right? But the other thing I noticed is that it, coming directly out of the Blake Archive, and it's only because I've been doing an awful lot of reviewing of these books, that the archive itself had a sort of creative feedback loop that actually then led to more traditional forms of scholarship as well. I mean, so, it seems to me, is that part of the mission here is that not only do we create sort of these new venues of publication, to take advantage of the technologies that are available, but also that the technologies themselves then actually stimulate work that then shows up in more traditional ways.
I don't think that we ever do non-traditional. There are things that we do, and they basically are two. We do reception history, and we do production history. And we do interpretation through that double helix of activity. And that's it. There's nothing else that we do. Because everything that we're involved with is the investigation and the preservation of cultural memory. So production and reception history is the whole ball of wax. Whether you're working with paper-based materials or whether you're working with digital materials and tools, it doesn't make any difference. That's what you're going to do. I don't know, however, what scholarship in humanities, literary studies, and humanities generally will look like when people actually are communicating digitally all the time and only using books another resource that now has been remediated in a digital form. You go to the book, you know, for the information that it has, and it has been remediated. But suppose you're just thinking about these things in wholly digital ways. We don't do that. But we're beginning to have to do that. And so what our scholarship will look like, say, 50 years from now, I haven't really a clue. It could really be quite different.
Just one prophecy a night, so you can't
squeeze another prophecy. Right. Only one, right. Well, thank you for listening.